I was reflecting earlier today what the title of my reflections should be. And I'm not sure, but one possible title would be, "What's with the question mark?" What's with the question mark? You might remember that Tony, in this morning's instructions, spoke about how the words, the question in and of itself, what is this, is not as important as the question mark at the end of the words. And it seems to me that's quite a salient point. What's with the question mark? And so this afternoon I'd like to pick up on some of the things that Tony described and spoke about, more in terms of the practice of questioning. This morning's instructions, very much encouragement, how do we practice with the question? And for me, this afternoon, I'd like to reflect and talk a little bit about the process of questioning. What happens when we question? Why do we question? And also to reflect on how, when we question, or how the practice of questioning and listening, I might also add, how that process might morph into something, become something that we don't so much do, we don't do it so much, as we become. We become, or we be. In other words, to reflect on what it might be to experience questioning as a sensation. Tony also mentioned the word sensation of questioning this morning. And so that's what I'm interested in. To consider the practice of questioning and listening as a process in which we cultivate, or what is cultivated, is a certain attitude, if you like, or a perspective, an inner perspective, that over time, if we continue with this practice, begins to infuse our life more and more, begins to inform our life more and more, and shape it, in fact, on a very pragmatic and practical level. It might shape how we respond to and engage with our lives, with life, with the world that we find ourselves in. And when I was reflecting earlier on the metaphor of infusion, of an infusion, it came to me the practice is a little bit like we take a vegetable, a marrow, and we marinate it. And in time, if the marinade is a good strong marinade and we give the process time, when we eat the marrow, it will have taken on the flavor of the marinade. So something about that. How does the practice of questioning infuse our life such that it begins to shape and form and inform not only ourselves, our lives, but I want to say almost more importantly, but equally importantly, how we respond to and engage to the world that we find ourselves in. And I would also like to say a few words about the effort that is involved in this process, effort or efforting. And many of you are familiar, of course, effort, virya, as one of the tenets in the Eightfold Path. So an important practice, effort. Effort or energy. What is the kind of effort that we need to make with this particular practice? And what I'm particularly interested in the effort is a specific effort that we have to make with this questioning, which hopefully will become clear as I describe it. An effort that has at its core the quality of ease or relaxation that Tony was also talking about this morning. How is it that we can relax into the practice? How is it that we can ease into the practice such that it begins to be more natural rather than something that is simply imposed? And I'd like to start by stating what seems to be the obvious. That in most cases, when we ask a question, implicit in that is the acknowledgement that we don't know. What is the day today? We ask because we don't know, even if just for that moment, or we might not be certain, or we can't remember, but the bottom line is we don't know at that point in time. And I don't know how it is for any of you, but certainly for myself, as I get older, I realize just how much I don't actually know. The older I get, the more I realize, the more I can acknowledge, the more I can admit, if truth be told, I don't actually know. And also, if truth be told, I don't particularly need to know or want to know. And that can feel at times, in certain situations, enormously relieving and liberating and reassuring. And here I want to stress, I really want to emphasize that the movement or the opening to not needing or wanting to know as I get older doesn't mean to say that I don't question. It doesn't mean that I don't question. It doesn't mean to say that I don't care. It doesn't mean to say that I'm not interested in. But the need to know is decreasing. So on the one hand, not knowing, certainly in my experience, can be freeing, can create a space, can be opening, can be liberating. On the other hand, in different circumstances, in different situations, not knowing might evoke very different feelings, of course. Feelings such as insecurity or anxiety or overwhelm, those kind of feelings. So an example from my own personal life, on June the 2nd this year, I will be leaving the place where I have been working and living for the last couple of years, and I'm hoping to go back to South Africa at the end of the year. But I don't really know what I'm going to be doing between June and December. There are some ideas, there are some hopes, there are some plans. And there are times where that feels wonderful and thrilling and opening and exciting. And then there are times when it feels very not those things. It feels anxious-making, it feels tense, I worry, I get concerned. I think, oh, no, I'm going to go back to South Africa in June. No, that's the fear speaking. That's the fear informing. So the both and. So acknowledging that I don't know, as I said, acknowledging that doesn't mean that I don't care. Doesn't mean to say that I'm not interested, already said. It's not something that we feel we have to resign ourselves to. Ugh, we don't know. Is that actually, we don't know. Not at all. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Acknowledging that I don't know opens up a space. It's a space in which everything and anything is possible. Anything can come up, as it will. Something will come up. Something will come up. And we can open up to that space if we receive it, if we pay attention to it. And, of course, if we also pay attention to what happens in response to what has arisen in that space. Do we grasp the pleasant? Do we push away the unpleasant? And yet, can we not develop the capacity to hold it all, to open to it all, the both and? A space I would almost want to describe as a space in which I might open to the wonder, to the perplexity of being here at all. Tony was talking about that this morning. The sheer perplexity of finding ourselves here at all. But in order to do that, I have to be present. In order to open into that sensation of perplexity, that sensation of wonder, I have to be awake, I have to be alert. So, as a perspective, as an attitude, questioning what is this without needing to know, or without needing to provide an answer means that I can open up more and more. I can accept and embrace more and more of life's totality. All of it. The messiness, the joys, the sorrows, the delight, the bitter, the sweet. What I would call the bittersweet nature of life, of my life, of life in general, of the world. Both and. Both and. Never just the one. Never just the other. Both and. And for me, that space that we open into when we ask the question can also hold any number of divergent opinions, views, and experiences. Whereas we might consider, or I might consider, knowledge as a thing, as something that has the potential to polarize, to divide, to separate, to split those who know from those who don't know, to divide, to polarize those who know one thing from those who know another thing. And for me, that is certainly one of the reasons why practicing with this question, what is this, seems indeed an appropriate perspective, an attitude to cultivate, to grow, to develop, to immerse myself in these times, in this world, where there is more than enough evidence, it's more than obvious, of just how damaging, how violent, how harmful and divisive any form of polarization can be. Polarization, two sides, two aspects, let alone to begin to untangle the complexities of who knows or who thinks they know what and why. To know in this context, to know, to be certain, can at times feel a little bit like a full stop. Something that can be held rather tightly. Something that can feel rigid or fixed. And there is very little space for change and creativity. I know. Oh, okay. Sorry. Not much is possible in that space. And of course, looking around traditionally, historically, knowing, knowledge, has conferred a certain status in certain societies and cultures. We're all aware of that. And there are plenty of examples in the world right here, right now, in the world, not in this room, where having specific and particular kinds of knowledge confers power. To know, knowing, being certain, can instill a certain measure of confidence or leverage in a person, regardless of whether that knowledge is justified or not, whether that leverage is justified or not. And personally, I sometimes consider that thing of knowledge as part of the scaffolding that holds up and perpetuates and supports what might in fact be an inflated sense of self, not to talk about ego. And that, of course, is evident in a physical posture, kind of I know, I am certain, that kind of energy. Whereas the posture of not knowing is a very different one, a physical posture of not knowing, of being deflated, of kind of collapsed, very, very different. And that is obvious, inner and outer postures of knowing and not knowing. Not knowing also seems to me not to get the same airtime as knowing does. And not knowing is also not something, as far as I know, it's not valued a whole lot, let alone encouraged in most societies. We are taught to know, we are taught to understand knowledge as something that is worthwhile to strive towards. And of course there are times for all of us, certain situations, under certain conditions, where knowing might evoke a sense of safety, of security, of familiarity. Of course, it may act as a buffer between us and the world, a world that is defined, after all, in terms of its unreliability and unsatisfactory and uncertainty. It might also shield us, it might protect us from having to accept that when all is said and done, the bottom line, which is not negotiable, the only certainty that there is of course that of impermanence, anicca, including the impermanence, the anicca of this particular body, heart, mind sitting in the chair. And that too will come to an end. But of course, what we don't know is when that will be. And so we think we know it, but do we really? Do we really? And in this context, there is another question that I bring into my reflections, into my practice. It's another koan. Tony spoke about koans as a reflection that don't really have answers. And the koan in this particular context, being with the certainty of death and the uncertainty of the timing, goes like this. As death is certain and the timing of death uncertain, what should I do? I'll say it again. As death is certain and the timing of death uncertain, what should I do? I have a friend who says, Katrin, that is just so morbid whenever I speak of this question. For me, it's not morbid at all. It is an invitation, it's an encouragement to pause, to stop me in my tracks and really reflect, what is it that is of greatest importance to you in this life? What is it that you want to invest in? What is it that you want to cultivate? What is it that you want to cultivate less of? So it's not morbid. It reminds me of the poignancy of this life, the tenderness of this life, the fragility of this life that rests, as Martine would say, on a single breath. And if I not know it, but if I infuse myself with that sensation, it might inform a response in my life and in the world that I find myself in. In the face of this fundamental bottom line uncertainty, this unreliability, in times when the conditions of our lives might feel overwhelming, asking the question, what is this, might ironically, actually, offer a certain container or a groundedness, a place that we can go to, a reference point, something that can hold us because it opens up, whereas feeling overwhelmed or tense or anxious is something that certainly in my experience closes me off, tightens me. It's this posture. What is this opens me up? Doesn't take away the anxiety, doesn't take away the tension, but it creates space around it. And it creates the possibility of within that space that a way of being with that which is difficult might appear. What I also find interesting about the question, what is this, is that as much as we might consider what is this in terms of an open-ended reflection, as I'm describing, without an answer, no answer, we can't but help lean into the question, as it were, lean into that space once it has been created. What is this? Listening. Not for anything, but just the practice, the act of listening. So in the same way that we're not looking for an answer once we've asked the question, what is this, we are also not listening for something to arise in that space. And I will talk tomorrow about the practical applications of listening. We'll practice listening tomorrow. But just for now, in relation to questioning, listening into the space is more of an opening, more of a widening the awareness to receive whatever will emerge into that space. So listening, as it were, in this context is more like being fully present, being fully awake, being fully present and paying attention to what will arise in this space. We don't know what it will be, we don't know when it will be, but something will arise. But if we're not receptive, as I've been saying, if we're not present, we won't notice. Listening means receptive, almost as if we were sensing the sensation of questioning, the sensation of listening. Sensing sounds, as I will describe tomorrow, with our whole being, in the way that Tony was describing, an embodied questioning. What does that mean? The sensation of questioning and listening. And what comes to my mind is the posture, the sensation of listening in a wild animal in the bush when it hears a rustle close by or the snort of another animal and then knowing how to respond. And while, of course, we're not wild animals and we might not have to be as vigilant as the animal in the bush when we listen, but certainly we can also bring the qualities of vibrancy and brightness into listening in that open-ended way. Those qualities that Tony was describing. Vibrancy, brightness, clarity, calm. Also, when we listen in that open-ended way, that open space, there's possibility of compassion arising quite spontaneously. Compassion. If we don't place ourselves in the foreground of the listening practice. In other words, compassion in action as I open up and just listen in this space, rather than being there just for myself, stopping for something, for a gap, so that I might say or respond. So, for example, excuse me, can we lean back when we listen? Can we lean back, not only physically as I'm doing now, leaning back, but also metaphorically, inwardly? Can I take myself back, not out, but just back a little bit to create space for what I'm hearing? For the person, for the sound, for the whatever, to take up the space and me receive it. To be fully present, to trust the process of listening, and then possibly to find myself surprised or even astonished by what might come out of my mouth much more spontaneously than if I was kind of waiting for a pause before I can jump in and say something. So something about trusting the process, leaning back and really receiving, and then finding ourselves possibly surprised by what might come out. Back to the practice of questioning, which of course can also be difficult at times. No doubt, most of us throughout the course of the day have found it at times possibly challenging, difficult, boring, nothing's going on. Of course, being human. For some of us, the wide open space that we are left with after having asked the question might feel daunting, might feel overwhelming, might be meaningless. And we might feel somewhat lost or disorientated. Or our practice can become somewhat vague, dull, or we might even begin to dissociate. Or for others, questioning in the way that we are doing these days may also feel overly internal, self-referential, narcissistic at times. And I think all of these would be fair comments if that was all that was going on. But of course it's not. For me, in the times that the practice feels difficult, boring, dull, nothing's much going on, agitated, all of the hindrances that I'm sure we are all very familiar with, we need to remember, as Tony was also encouraging us this morning, the qualities of curiosity, qualities of interest into the process. That might help to enliven, that might help to re-energize the process. We can also remind us of our intention that I spoke about last night. What is my intention of being here right now, Not even yesterday, not even tomorrow. Here, right now, what is the intention? And from time to time, checking into that might also help to re-energize, to recalibrate the process. Of course, also what we have been doing from time to time in the course of today is to remind ourselves that what helps to support the practice is staying in the body. We sit, we walk, we move, we sleep, we eat, and so on, and so on. The body as that which grounds me, the body in which the process takes place. The breath can act as an anchor, as we were talking about earlier, the movement in the chest, in the belly, or the contact of body against the wall, against the cushion, against the floor, the contact that the body makes with any supportive surface underneath. And simply also the possibility of remembering more often, sati, to remember more often, to simply be present, to pay attention. That is always available, always. For me, the place where questioning, an open space, and listening meet is the place that holds the potential for creativity. I'd also like to say for healing, for possible transformation. Wisdom and compassion can arise when we let go of fixed views and opinions, when we take back projections and judgments, when the ego is contained, and when we are no longer held captive by our habitual patterns of reactivity. There is freedom in those moments when we experience, as I'm sure we have all, when we experience the ungrasping of something that we have grasped, when we turn towards that which is unpleasant rather than turning away. Those are moments of real freedom. Do we recognize them as such? Do we take courage from those? Do we trust them? And are these moments not what is described in the third of the four truths, the end to dukkha, the end to suffering? Or, to use words from a slightly more secular approach, the end of reactive patterns, the end of reactivity. We've all had those moments. Have we noticed? Have we paid attention? We've all experienced those moments spontaneously from time to time, I'm sure, for most of us. However, they don't come naturally. We have to make an effort. And that's what I'd like to turn my attention to now. Just a few words about effort. So for some of us, perhaps, practicing with an open-ended question like, what is this, might want us to figure out an answer. We might be practicing, or the answer, what is the right answer, focusing, concentrated, tense. We have to get the answer, and of course it has to be the right answer. And we concentrate and we focus. While for others, the open-ended question might suit very well, psychologically, emotionally, because we might feel, ugh, I don't have to make a real effort. I can just hang out in this vague, open space where anything and everything can happen, and I don't really have to make a big effort. And actually, I would question if that was appropriate. I would question, is there something going on in that space, or is it just a dissociated space? And I'm sure we're all aware and familiar with the classical Buddhist metaphor that is most often used to describe or to talk about effort in relation to practice. And that, of course, is the metaphor of the string instrument. A string instrument. When we consider a string instrument, it is designed to produce a sound, to create music, to resonate. Tony was talking about resonance, to resonate this morning. And we can also appreciate in a string instrument that in order to do this, in order for the string instrument to reach its full potential, that it is designed to do. The strings need to hold just the right amount of tension for the sound that is plucked then to resonate, to be clear, to be bright. Too much tension, the strings will snap. Too little tension, and the sound will be dull and flabby and not really go anywhere. It's a sound without resonance, a sound that cannot travel, cannot touch, cannot vibrate, cannot move around, a sound that we equally cannot be touched by. And for me, the word resonance as a quality is relational. Resonance, resonating, is relational. It's something that connects. It's something that I can be touched by. It's something that I can touch. Resonating, resonance. As opposed to, as I said, a dull, flat sound that doesn't go anywhere and doesn't touch anything. We can't be touched by either. And another metaphor that I also find very helpful, although it's not a classical Buddhist one, but personally I prefer this one, is that of a gong or a singing bowl. Similar to the string instrument, it is also designed to create a sound, a singing bowl. And here too, the sound can be clear, it can be bright, it can be resonant, but of course it can also be flat and dull. And this depends not only on the amount of force with which we strike the gong, but also, and this is the clue for me, on whether the bowl is empty or not. A bowl that has been filled with a piece of fabric or sand or tennis balls or rice or whatever, if that will be struck, the sound will not be clear and resonant and bright. It will not produce a sound that will be produced in a bowl that is empty. Emptiness, emptiness. If we think of the saying, that person is so full of themselves, certainly for me, that doesn't generally evoke a pleasant feeling. That person is so full of themselves. And perhaps that's a similar experience for some of you. And what does that mean, being full of ourselves, full of myself, if not full of views and opinions and judgments and assumptions and so on? I certainly, for myself, know that when I feel, oh, Katrin, you are being a little bit full of yourself, it's not a comfortable feeling. I'm not at ease with that. Either way, when too much or too little effort is made, or if the instrument is cluttered with unnecessary stuff and it's full, it's clogged up, the potential of that instrument to produce a clear sound that resonates outwardly and vibrates and can touch the world cannot be realized. And finally, another image that might also be useful when we consider an appropriate effort or its verb form, which is also an interesting one to explore, efforting, efforting. What does that mean? Where does that land? How does it resonate with me, efforting? It's the obvious one of the seesaw, a seesaw that needs an equal amount of weight on either side of the beam to be able to move smoothly, to stay in motion. Too much or too little on one or the other side of the beam will cause the beam to get stuck, to get stuck. The weight on either end needs to be balanced for there to be movement, for there to be something that is ongoing. And of course, it's at the middle point of that beam, between the too much and too little, that there lies the potential for an equilibrium, the potential for a still point, the point at the same time around which movement takes place. So the point of equilibrium, steadiness, and at the same time the potential for motion, for movement, for process, both those qualities, both and. And for me, that of course is the space that the Taoist would refer as wu wei, effortless effort, action and non-action, both and, never just the one. The thing with effort, regardless which direction, too much, too little, is that it's not fixed. It's not static. It's something in relation to practice, in relation to asking the question, that is a process that we might refer to or describe as efforting. A process that can change, is adaptable, is flexible, and needs to be adjusted or tweaked according to the circumstances and the conditions that we find ourselves in. Much in the same way that I imagine we have all, throughout the day, needed to tweak a little bit the effort here, turn it up, turn it down. We have needed to adjust the effort we have made according to how we feel, to what's going on, whether I'm hungry, am I tired, whatever has been going on. The effort has been dynamic, it hasn't been static. One of the words that is closely associated for me with the wu-wai, effortless effort, in the context of questioning and listening, is that quality that I was saying at the beginning, of ease, of relaxation, letting be, letting go, allowing it all and embracing. And when I went in search of where I might find the word ease or relaxation in the Buddhist teaching, I found a lovely metaphor for this in the word, in the Pali word sukha. Sukha, you might be familiar with those who practice yoga, sukha, or of course Sanskrit and Pali, the word sukha. Literally translated, sukha means a good axle hole. Su refers to good, and ka is an axle hole. So to illustrate, just imagine a wooden cart with wheels. And of course the wheels are made up of the outer hub, and the outer rim, and an inner hub, from which the spokes then radiate outward and connect hub and rim. The hub at the center of the wheel is a hole into which the shaft or the axle fits, and that then, together with a whole lot of other knots and nuts and bolts, sets the wheel in motion. So in other words, a good axle hole, sukha, is one that is uncluttered. Again, the image of a space that is open and free of stuff. It is an uncluttered, empty space into which the shaft fits or the ankle fits, and then together with all the other components sets the wheel in motion. And this is, after all, its potential. This is its purpose, to turn the wheel. So again, as with the image of the singing bowl, the notion of an uncluttered, open-ended space, or an empty space, if you like, that will allow for the potential of the wheel to be realized, to be manifest. As opposed to, and this is an interesting one for me, as opposed to a bad axle hole, as in dukkha, in which the hole is cluttered up and it's clogged up, and it can't set the wheel in motion. So in this image then of sukha, ease could be considered as something that will allow and encourage for an unfolding of an experience, and that supports that experience as an ongoing, continuing one. It's a process, the wheel in motion, rather than something that is static. Ease, relaxation, as something which sustains the flow of life, as opposed to the axle hole, dukkha, where we can find ourselves all clogged up, gummed up, tense, and making it impossible for the flow of life to get going. And here too, what is also important and interesting for me, the axle hole is only as good as it provides a space for the shaft to fit into, and then to, together with a whole lot of other structures, forms part of a whole mechanism of the wheel that then sets in motion the movement. The hole on its own serves very little purpose, serves very little function. So again, the emphasis here on a wider perspective that speaks about relationships, speaks about the way that the individual parts fit together, and essentially describes how the sum total is always greater than its individual parts. And then to end off with, just to return to half an hour ago, what I was saying at the beginning of these reflections, where I was sharing that what inspires me is how the practice of questioning and listening, which we'll be introducing tomorrow, how that process might morph over time into something that I don't so much do, not so much doing, but rather something that I might become, that I might be in the world. And then to end off with a lovely quote from a Zen teacher who articulates this process of morphing very beautifully for me. And this is what he says. Buddhist practice pulls both ways. From one perspective, it is a discrete activity. It is something we do. From another perspective, one which tends to emerge more clearly with time, it seems less something we do and more something we are. Less a piece of life and more all of life.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.